Robert Luke, prisoner number 1118AZ, arrived at Alcatraz Federal Penitentiary on April 14, 1954, and he was paroled on April 29, 1959. It was the smell of fresh-mown grass wafting across the island from somewhere in San Francisco that stimulated the transformative moment in Luke's life, and it spurred him to go the straight and narrow path. He's 88 years old now, and he's been out of prison for 56 years. But it was only 5 years ago, when he first confided to anyone other than his immediate family, that he was an ex-con. As part of Robert Luke's healing process, he authored a revealing book about his life on the rock, entombed in Alcatraz. And he now returns to Alcatraz Island on a regular basis, where he has achieved rock star status, regaling visitors from around the world about his recollections of his life at Alcatraz, and of course, autographing his top-selling book. I had the pleasure of spending part of a weekend with Luke while attending the Fall 2015 Alcatraz Alumni Association's annual reunion. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me on Alcatraz Island, administered today by the National Park Service, for a conversation with Robert Luke, and you'll discover just how a whiff of fresh-cut grass transformed his life.
So this is a real interesting day for you, isn't it?
All the days the last 5 years have been very interesting.
This weekend is a special weekend in the history of Alcatraz, isn't it?
Yeah, it's supposed to be a special one. Yeah, well, they have the reunion on Sunday, so this will be my sixth reunion this Sunday.
Do you have any idea how many former prisoners are going to be here?
Only two of us.
Wow, you're going to be the stars.
Be me and Bill Baker.
A naive question. When you talk about a con or an ex-con, how do you address yourself? Am I an ex-con or an ex-prisoner?
Ex-con.
Ex-con, yeah. It's kind of like a diploma.
Yeah, a diploma, yeah.
When did you first come to Alcatraz?
I got here April 14th, 1954.
Remember that day?
Oh, yeah, very clearly.
They brought you on the boat, didn't they?
Yeah, we come out in the old Warden Johnson 60-foot launch they had, Alcatraz boat, from over in East Bay, Richmond in the East Bay. And there was eight of us on the chain, come from Leavenworth. And I was shackled, my left ankle, the right ankle, another prisoner, and we were all handcuffed.
So at the time, this was the first super prison in America. Make it the unescapable prison.
It was the punishment prison for the federal government. And I knew about Alcatraz long before I ever got there, because guys coming back would talk about it. And I knew about it when I was in San Quentin. Yeah, so I knew what I was going to.
So it was not a surprise for you.
Yeah, well, you know, what you hear is the food's good. You had your own cell. You had yard on Saturday and Sunday and weekends. Everybody worked. They had movies if you wanted to go to them, if you qualified. So what else do you need when you're doing time?
It sounds like pretty good duty.
Huh? Might as well don't go there, right? Yeah. But the place was very depressing. It felt like you were being squashed all the time. You know, so small, and you couldn't move anywhere. I mean, you went where they told you, when they told you, and there was no freedom of movement at all, anywhere, anytime, except out in the yard, of course.
I think a lot of people imagine it being a prison of 500 or 1,000 prisoners, but that was never the case, was it?
Oh, no, 270 or something like that.
At the most, right?
And the prison fit that many prisoners. So I was in San Quentin, there was 2,000 prisoners there. So it's a big difference. And you can move around and stay out. And you're only in your cell, only to sleep at night. So a lot of difference.
Yeah. Sounds like, again, pretty good duty compared to Leavenworth or even San Quentin.
Well, it was very depressing.
What was the most depressing part? What got you?
It morbid is a perfect word for it. There was no laughter. There was no, I mean, you were just there. There was really nothing really to do except read, which I did a lot of.
But why would not have Leavenworth or San Quentin been as depressing?
I think it was because you could move around. I think that was the big thing. You know, movement, a little bit of movement.
Right, but isn't that a good thing?
Yeah, to be able to move, yeah. In Alcatraz, you couldn't do that. You couldn't go visit or move or stand on the tier and talk. And in the cell house, you couldn't talk unless it was the person next door to you.
Uh-huh.
And very softly, so there was never any loud noise there.
And Why was that? Why was there a reason? Explain to you why they did that, why they had that treatment?
Well, that was part of the control. I mean, they had full control of it. So I remember one night I hollered after I was there about 3 years to open some windows at night. Spent 5 days in a hole for that. Just holler. So that's how strict they were.
Did you go to the hole for any other infractions?
I was there about 4 or 5 months, and one night I just got fed up with everything, frustrated, and I broke my cell up, set fire to everything, including my clothes. So they come and got me out of there and took me over to D Block and put me in the dark hole. And I was in there, I thought, 29 days. No clothes, no bedding, hole in the floor for a toilet, and very little food. Pretty tough.
How did you keep your mind together? Because you never lost it in there, did you?
No. I worked out. You know, they had bars across the part of the front. And so I did push-aways from them and leg lifts, push-ups, walked. When I got tired, I lay down on the steel floor and go to sleep, you know, for, what, 15, 20 minutes or whatever. And then I could always go away on a trip that appeared in my mind.
So you mentally would just leave?
Just go away. Yeah, just become part of a book or go somewhere where I was in the Navy after World War II and during World War II. And I just go somewhere where I was in the Navy.
Was there any favorite go-to place for you?
Oh, any place to go to? No, I don't think there's any favorite place. I mean, you just, whatever comes in your mind, well, that's what you do.
And that really worked for you, didn't it?
Oh, it really worked. It worked for me all the time. 11 years I was in prison. So it worked for me everywhere.
As I remember, we met months ago, and wasn't there an episode where you lost control and you beat up another prisoner, or was that in a previous prison?
I did that in Alcatraz, and down the laundry in 1957.
What happened? What made you just...
The guy just popped off to me, and I went after him and broke his jaw, and he left Alcatraz. He went to Springfield, Missouri to get his jaw fixed and never come back.
What was it that made you snap? Do you think it was cumulative?
No, I just never took any crap from anybody. I was hot-tempered and I was pretty violent if I had to be.
But most of the other cons knew that, right?
Oh, yeah.
It
comes with you.
Yeah. So they steered. Even before you got there, the word was out about you.
I beat a guy up in Leavenworth real bad. One in McNeil Island. Guy in San Quentin, L.A. County Jail, everywhere. So, you know, you get that reputation.
At one point, you were talking about you went to McNeil Island Federal Penitentiary in Washington. Why?
Well, I got caught bank robbery with a machine gun, so I got 2 10-year sentences. And then I was up there about 5 6 months, beat up another prisoner, and they sent me to Leavenworth. So then I tried to escape from Leavenworth, and they sent me to Alcatraz.
So at some point, there was a shift in your thinking, and you just decided you were done with prison, right?
Yeah, I was sitting out in the steps in the yard looking over the wall at the bridge.
The Golden Gate?
Yeah. And I had about 10 months left of the federal sentence, and I had a hold on me from the state of California for a parole violation, so they're just going to come and get me, take me back over to San Quentin when on federal time was done. So I was sitting there looking, and all of a sudden I got a whiff of new-mown grass. And it just did something to me. I asked myself, what am I doing here when I could be out there smelling the new-mown grass? And then, why am I here? So I went all the way back why I was there and come to the conclusion everything I'd done was by my own choice. Nobody made me do it. And as soon as I really believed that, all the hatred went out of me. I couldn't blame anybody else for anything. And I was ready to get out of prison and make a life outside. So that's what happened to me.
And that was, what, 1958?
That was probably in late 1958, right.
So then you got out. Something happened.
I got out, yeah. I wrote a whole chapter in my book about that called Epiphany, about that awakening out there that day. And... So then 3 days before they come and got me from San Quentin, warden called me up in front of the cell house. They had a desk up there out in front of IA block and handed me a letter. And I had to read that 3 4 times and still didn't understand it. I said, what does this mean? He says, it means you're going to be free in 3 days. State of California released me to full-time serve. So I walked out of Alcatraz free.
Wow.
I stayed out. So first couple of years was pretty tough, and I gradually got over to the being in prison thing and made it.
And you had a whole career, right? Didn't you in restaurant, maitre d'? Or?
Well, I was a waiter in restaurants. And
some pretty fancy restaurants in San Francisco.
Drapery installer.
You were with a pretty fancy restaurant in San Francisco.
I was a French waiter, French and silver service, cart, table, whole bit, carving, a whole bit. So I worked in San Francisco at Ernie's 2 years, then a year at Ondine and Sausalito. So then I got tired of it.
And for the last more than 50 years, you've been out of prison.
I've been out 56 years.
56. And what I find fascinating, I remember last time I was with you, you barely told anybody, even relatives didn't know, correct?
The only people that knew about me for 51 years was my family. Why would I tell anybody? It's nothing to be proud of. And so when I come back 5 years ago, the first time after that, everybody knew about me. So that was my secret. You know, why would I tell? So nobody knew.
And so, again, it was 5 years ago that you first returned to Alcatraz.
Yeah, 2010, the reunion in 2010.
And what was that like?
Well, it was very confusing. I wasn't expecting what all the people and the way I was greeted down the Alcatraz cruise's landing. And just the one confusing thing after another. All day it was that way, so... So that was the first time I ever get a speech in front of somebody in the mess hall, and I could do it. Didn't even know I could do that.
Did you ever imagine that you'd wind up kind of being a star and a celebrity in a sense?
I call myself a fake celebrity because, you know, I mean, what did I do to become this? I was an idiot of a prison.
You know? And here you are in the twilight of your life with a book, author, and kids and whatnot come out to the island, to the rock, to have you autograph and sign your books, and they're just looking at you in amazement.
Yeah, you know, you take pictures, ask questions, and then some of them get my book, and I autograph it for them. So I do that about three times a month, something to do.
Does it help you at all, being with the kids and being
well,
there?
People, not so many kids, just a lot.
People in general.
Yeah, people from all over the world. Then, of course, my wife, Ida, comes with me. Every place I go, she goes. And without her, I wouldn't be here. That's for sure. So she's my personal assistant on the days we go somewhere like today.
When the kids and the tourists and people come to Alcatraz and they realize that you are an ex-con, an author, what is the most interesting questions that they ask you that you think are the most fascinating?
Well, the first question they ask, or the first most, is did I know Al Capone? Well, he was dead long before I got there. And the next one was, you ever over in the dark hole, you know, or were you ever scared, you know? So, you know, the usual questions, I guess, you get asked. So people are just interested in what you, you know, your story there.
So, but there were some legends left on the rock when you were there, right?
Yeah, of course, the Birdman was there, and Machine Gun Kelly, Creepy Carpus, and then Bumpy Johnson was one.
I seem to remember that you had some sort of interaction with Creepy Carpus.
Yeah, I shelled next to him for 2 years, and we never spoke. So that's the way it was there. You had three or four friends you talked to, and everybody else you ignored.
Right there in line, Chow Hall or whatever.
Yeah, you just ignore everybody.
Like they weren't even there.
Yep, yeah. That's the best way to do it.
Bob Luke. Thank you so
much.
You. What an honor and a pleasure to see you again.
Yeah, you too.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from San Francisco.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show, Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a weekly featured podcast on NPR.org, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. Our San Francisco-based associate producer is Molly Blaisdell, covering the San Francisco Bay Area, the island of Maui, and the South Pacific. Our Wisconsin-based associate producer is Julie Henning,